Before we begin, I would like to emphasize that this podcast is separate from my teachings and work at Del Seton Medical Center. Any discussions we have on this podcast is for entertainment purposes only and in no way connected to Del Seton Medical Center. Hello, everyone. This is Lucas Ferrer, and this is Miguel Montero Baker, and this is the Life of Flow podcast. Today, we have a super interesting episode where we talk to Ryan Tannell. He's the founder and CEO of his own real estate investment company, and I've been fortunate enough to witness how he's created this. And today he's going to come talk to us about one of the ways we can achieve financial freedom and freedom in life, basically, by investing our money and doing it in a way that helps us basically achieve our goals outside of the operating room. So without further ado, Miguel,
let's do it.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Welcome, Ryan.
Hey, Ryan.
Thank you so much for...
Guys, really cool to be a part of this.
One of the things that I've been thinking of more lately is it doesn't matter how hard I work, Brian, I have a ceiling, right? As a physician... If my trait is treating people, if my trait is operating and doing procedures, there's only so many hours in the day that I can do that. And so it gets to the point where your wealth acquisition just plateaus. There's absolutely nothing you could do. Yes, you may be changed to a different institution. Yes, you may be go into private practice. And maybe you can limit your overhead to create a little bit more gain. But at the end of the day, there's a limiting factor, which is there's not enough time and hours in the day in which you could be your craft. And at least, you know, Lucas is way more versed than me, and he's seen the light earlier than I. I'm a little bit older than Lucas. But at my age in the mid-40s, you start realizing I need to create exponential wealth so that possibly within the next 15 years... maybe 20 years, I can step down from my craft and I don't need to worry. And maybe there's some passive income coming. And maybe when I'm on vacation, I'm not worrying that I'm depleting my bank account, right? Mm-hmm. And so part of, Life of Flow podcast is talking to, our followers about stuff that is not scientific in nature and is not necessarily technical in nature, but it's stuff that to both Lucas and myself is important in life, right? It could be religion, it could be culture, it could be art, it could be music. And today it's finance.
Yeah.
And so Ryan, I've had also the pleasure of meeting you before through Lucas. You are not only a phenomenal business person, but you're just a fun guy, a great guy to talk to. And of course, when Lucas brought the name to the table, I was incredibly enthusiastic of just having this conversation with you. So maybe we'll have our you can give us a 30,000 foot view for our listeners. What do you do? What's your art form? What's your craft, Ryan? And how are you going to convince the 1.5 million people that follow us? Wink, wink, wink. That they should possibly reach out to you at the end of this show and say, hey, man, I've got a little bit of money stored and I am like Miguel or Lucas and I'm thinking outside of the box. How should we do this?
Sure, absolutely. No, I appreciate it. And like you said earlier, I like a little bit of balance in life. You know, I don't mind working hard, but I want to enjoy the fruits of my work. So we're going to, you know, play loud music and we're going to go out on trips to Puerto Rico and, you know, we're going to live la vida loca a little bit. But yeah, as far as what I do, I mean, I've been doing real estate in general for 10 years, but the business that I've created now is essentially a private equity firm. So what we'll go out and do is we'll raise money from investor capital and then we'll use those funds to purchase apartment complexes. And for more or less, we'll flip them. So we'll buy something that's cheaper than it should be at a discount, and then we'll fix it up and then we'll sell it at market price at a profit. And we get to distribute all those profits to all the investors that helped put capital to the table. So similar, if you were to buy stock in Apple, you know, you're not the one making the microchips, but you get to share in their good times as the company grows in value. So it's same, just magnified with real estate, and it can be done a lot faster because we have much better deals and we're not a public company. We only work with private investors.
So Ryan, you said we, and Lucas kind of introduce you as you going on and doing your own thing. Would you clarify for us, is it really your own, or did you just go to a private company that does this and you're kind of one of the people that works there?
Yeah, definitely. So this is my company. I mean, I'm the CEO. I have two people that work with me that are essentially assistants. But when I say we, I refer to other general partners. So when we purchase apartment complexes, we'll buy something. Let's say it's a 50-unit apartment complex. You know, my strengths coming from a mortgage background, I can do the financing, the attorney work, the underwriting. I can make sure that we're hitting our pro forma budget numbers. But I have other partners on the team. Someone's an expert at construction. Someone's an expert at leasing, maintenance, property management. And usually those skills combine together to have an effective team where everyone can have their zone of influence, but be able to do a lot more deals a lot more effectively than having a one-man show try to do everything for 50 units at a time.
So Ryan, you know, when, you know, we go through this process and to become, you know, a physician and a surgeon, and through the whole process, you're not thinking at all about money. You just have this vague concept that at some point you'll have enough money to, you know, live a comfortable life. And you've seen people around you do it and you're like, oh, that should be pretty easy. And then you come to the realization that it's not. And then you start like looking, okay, like, let me start reading about books. And at some point you come in into like the way I started looking into it is like long-term rentals, right? Can you kind of explain, and we've talked about this a little bit, but to be honest, you know, you explain it much better than I can. What's the pros and cons between, because the easy way to get into real estate is, you know, you buy a house that cash flows a little bit, you make, you know, $500 at best a month in cash flow, and you hold it for 30 years and you have the equity at the end of 30 years. But say I have the same $100,000, $50,000 that I'm going to put down on the down payment. So what's the pros of putting it on a rental that's 20 minutes from your house that you can go check on, that you manage or you help manage? And what's the pros and what's the cons? And then what's the pros and cons of finding someone like you getting into one of these ventures?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's funny too, even though I've been in real estate doing mortgage loans at first, I was in the same place where, you know, for 7 years, I was accumulating a lot of cash coming in from my day job, and it was sitting in the bank account. And I work in real estate, so I would buy rental properties on my own and I would do the work to fix them up. But when my job was demanding and I was spending, you know, 9, 10, 11 hours a day in the office, I didn't have the time to go out and, you know, source 50 to 100 deals to find the best one. I didn't have the time to, you know, find good property management, oversee them, make sure they're doing the things they need to do, go out and pick the right light fixtures, the faucets, you know, the plumbers, making sure you're not getting overcharged. You know, there's a whole lot of work that goes into real estate. So it's a myth that there are passive investments. I mean, it's all a degree of to how passive or how active you want to be involved. So if you want to go off and buy a house, you can. There's some education around, you know, well, what is a good market to buy in? What's a good price point to buy in? What are some of the items that could come up during inspection I need to worry about or not? So you can learn all those things, you can, and you'll probably get better. But just like you guys have spent years doing, you know, medical school to get to where you are, it'll probably take a year or two or three of even full-time work before you really understand the nuances of real estate where you're good enough to do it effectively, much less compete against the private equity firms and people like us who are doing it, you know, full-time with teams who have years of experience. And so it's just kind of the degree of, would you rather try to learn this second job yourself and do the investing on your own? Or would you rather, you know, partner with experts who have been doing this for a while, who can find better deals, manage them more effectively, add scale, get cheaper materials, and just give the money back to you for doing all that work.
But can you talk about the numbers and, you know, so the return on investment, say on, you say you're good at it and you get a good long-term rental that cash flows $500 a month. And then same money, but the, you know, two separate scenarios. One goes to the one house and one goes to a project like yours.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, if you were to go off and buy a house, let's just say a $200,000 house, you know, it's hard to find that, at least here in Austin. You have to go to other cities now. But, you know, if you were to buy that and you rented it out, let's say for, $2,000 a month, your mortgage payment would probably be, you know, $1,400-$1,500 a month. You might have $100 to $200 for property management, and you might have a little bit of maintenance that comes up every now and then when you do repairs. So for easy numbers, let's say you do make $500 a month, you know, you do that times 12 for 12 months a year, you make $6,000. Over the course of the year, you'll get some depreciation on the house, so you get a little tax benefit. And the house will probably go up in value. I mean, it depends. Right now with where the market is, things have gone down a little bit. But a long-term trend over 5 or 10 years, we do expect, you know, 3 or 4% appreciation per year. And of course, when you pay your mortgage, you get some benefits. So you're getting all those benefits, but let's say 6,000 from the cash flow plus, you know, maybe another 5-10% on top of that with the other benefits. You know, and the reason is because that's something that's already ready to go. That doesn't, you know, if it's not bought at a discount or you're not renovating it. By comparison, our job is to find people or properties that need heavy discounts. So we won't do a deal unless we can guarantee, well, none of this is guaranteed, I guess, but unless we expect that we will make double an investor's initial capital within a 5-year time period. So that ends up being, you know, a 20% average annual return or a 15% internal rate of return. And it, another way to think about internal rate of return is that it compounds yearly. So if you were to invest, you know, 100,000 into the stock market at a 10% internal rate of return, the first year you'd make 10,000, but then the next year you'd have 110 invested. So you'd get 11,000 profit on your 110. So it keeps compounding and growing. So, you know, typically if people invest in the S&P 500, you'll get 8, 9, 10% rate of return. So we're typically double that, and we'll be able to double an investor's capital within those 5 years without them having to do anything other than, you know, say, yep, is a good deal. Sign me up.
So I have a question in this, and I've never done one of these, but I certainly understand the scrutiny that the bank will go through when it comes to your financial profile to determine, are you somebody that I should be able to give this money to? And so how do you go about this? So I have, you know, I'm a physician, I have some money in the bank, but hey, I've been in training, and this is a personal story. I was not very well versed on the way that the business happens in the US. And so when I came here many years ago, I bought a mattress, and I'm not joking, it was like a $500 mattress. And I did it over a 24 month period. Oh, and I thought, brilliant. I'm, you know, it's like $25 a month.
Yeah.
And of course, I didn't pay 2 or 3 months in a row. Then I have all these derogatory marks.
Yeah.
And even though I like had this really great job, I moved to Houston with like a credit score of like, you know, an ape,
yeah,
essentially. And so I couldn't even get a house, right? And I was like, no, but I'm like making, you know, $300,000-$500,000 a year, but my credit score is horrible because of all this, you know, stupidity in my early, because of them, and it was a shitty mattress. It wasn't like, oh my God, yeah, like my life became, it was a bad mattress.
Yeah.
It was just dumb decisions. But anyway, all to say that really limited my ability when I came to lenders. So is this in a way, if I have the liquidity to come to your firm and say, hey, I've got a couple of 100,000, or maybe I've got 50 or 1,000. How do you go about that? How do you take my money? Do you look at my credit profile? Is my credit score important? And are you using me potentially to finance this project other than for that potential 20% that you need to put down? Explain to me the dynamics of the macroeconomics happening in the back.
Sure. So the general classification, you have general partners who are like myself and our other teammates, where we're going to find the property, operate it, do all of that. And then there's limited partners, which would be the investors that say, all I'm going to do is contribute capital. I have no other role. I just want to be a part of it. The limited partners don't have to get approved by the loan. They don't have anything to do with it. That's all on the general partner's responsibility.
So I could have a credit score of 500. If I have $100,000 for this deal, you'll take it.
So there's two classifications. When we do these raises, they're monitored by the SEC. So if you're considered an accredited investor, you have the freedom to pretty much invest in any deal you like. The definition of accredited investor is your net worth outside of your primary residence is $1 million or more. So that includes investment property, stock, cash in the bank, automobiles, all that stuff. If the other way you can get qualified is if you alone made $200,000 a year for the last 2 years, and you're on track to make that or more this year. Or if you're married, you can do that with $300,000 a year between you and your wife combined. So if you meet either
just one, sorry to interrupt, but just for the clarity of the audience, the reason why this has been in place is because the SEC wants to make sure that you don't screw yourself, essentially, right? They want to make sure, hey, this guy's got enough bandwidth that he's going to get into this. And he knows, because essentially it's an investment, right? Mm-hmm. You may lose it all completely, or you may not, but they want to make sure that if you're doing this, you're playing with the big boys, meaning you have that bandwidth to get that hit. Is that correct, Ryan?
Yeah, absolutely. And it keeps the snake oil salesman and the shysters out of it to say, hey, here's this way, give me some money, and you're going to take it from people who really don't know how to evaluate these deals. And, you know, the $1 million net worth or the $200,000 is an arbitrary number, but the SEC had to draw the line somewhere. And they say, if you made that much, you have to be smart enough somehow to at least earn enough money to replace it if you lose it. And if you put 50 grand in investment, you know, it's not the end all be all of your life savings that you're going to lose at risk there.
And so what's the minimum? Okay, so to be succinct about the question, is you don't run my credit score?
Mm-hmm. We do not run your credit score.
You don't care. It's more about, can you come in with a certain amount? What's the minimum? What's the maximum play? Or is it project by project? How would you walk me through that?
So these are relationship business and these are private offerings. So our group, typically our minimums are $50,000 each, but you know, if we have a relationship, sometimes if someone has a special circumstance, we do let people on a one-off basis come in a little lower. Most of the time people bring, you know, between 50 and 200,000. There's no maximum other than the total raise. You know, if we're raising $3 million and one person wants to write a $3 million check, we'll certainly let them, you know, and you even have a little more benefit when you do that, because I'd much rather work with one person than, you know, with 40 on some of these deals. So
how do I become educated about this? Because,
to this podcast.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, I have a relationship with you. I know your work ethic. I know your personality. You know, so I have an upside that even though I know very little about the business, I know your character, and I know that this is kind of like your passion. So there's an implicit trust that I have, and I think overall, if you know, people could find that, they'll do better. But how does somebody that just graduated, has a bunch of debt, got their first job in, you know, Springfield, Missouri, doesn't know anybody there, you know, and wants to, you know, start building a financial future, find, first of all, understand what this is, you know, learn about it, know how to identify the basics of what is a good deal and a bad deal. And then how does that person meet someone like you to kind of get into one of these ventures if they so choose to?
So, you know, these investments are not necessary for someone fresh out of school that's, you know, got $100,000 in debt. You know, I'd rather them work their career and get a nice savings.
Really good signing bonus, Ryan.
Yeah. But yeah, if you're already established and you want the passive route of investing, you know, we've got a YouTube channel and an Instagram account where we go through education on, hey, here's how we found this property. Here's why it's a good deal. Here's the numbers on what the numbers should be. And here's what to look for about potential hazards that'll get you into trouble. So we cover that all on our YouTube channel. There's plenty of other real estate podcasts and books that you can read if you want to dive into some more of the details. And then as far as meeting people like us, you know, we do sponsored events. Where we'll come out and talk at some real estate networking event communities, typically real estate investment clubs are in most local cities, or, you know, if you just get on Google and type in, you know, passive syndication, investing in real estate, you know, that's the name of this type of investment. You'll find a number of operators like myself, and, you know, we do deals here in Texas. So if you're in Texas, you know, come on, say hi.
It's essentially, how would I evaluate your track record? Right. I mean, you know, $50,000, $100,000, that's money. Mm-hmm. And I'm about to give it to a company that's going to manage it and potentially, hopefully, bring it back to me. But is there a track record of some sort that our listeners can say, like, well, I want to know, you know, has he had 10 home runs in a row? Has it been maybe a couple of flops? Or is that information readily available, Ryan?
Yeah, sure. So our website, Top Producer Investment Capital, it lists all the deals that we've done in the past. So you can go on and you can see the price that we purchased each property at. You can see what the rents were and what the revenue was when we bought it. You can see before and after videos of how how the construction went, how the finished product turned out. And then you can see our investor letters that we send out quarterly. Every quarter that we do these, they're all available where everyone can go in and say, you know, how was quarter two of the first year you bought it? How was, you know, quarter three of the second year you bought it? What was the pro forma profit, what you thought you were going to make? How did that compare with what you actually made? Were there any surprises that came up? So we're transparent about all of that. We make it available on our website. We have investor testimonials with people that have invested with us before and their stories about, you know, potential hesitations getting in and trusting somebody else with their money and, you know, learning about the process and then their, you know, results, you know, a year or two later after they've come through and said, okay, well, here's what actually happened through the process. So testimonials, you know, quarterly letters, video of before and after footage, and then just seeing the, you know, reports of the budgeted versus the actuals and how much profits are actually distributed on previous deals. We're transparent about all that.
So is your investment tied to a project? Is every investment tied to a project, or is it more like a holding company where I'm putting money, you're managing maybe four or five of these, and depending on how they go, you know, you're going to give me an ROI specifically, and you're dropping a little bit of the risk I have, or am I going all in with the project? And as a consumer, I have to be very, very critical of what project you're going into and saying, no, I love the place where it's at. I love the potential that it has and I love what they can do. So I'm going to go all in that particular project. Or, you know, is it how married is it to each one of the dealings?
You get to pick which project you invest in. This isn't a general fund. You like keep all hold of your money. And then what we'll typically do is, you know, I never know when and where the next deal is going to come, but when it comes, it happens quickly. So we'll get a phone call and they'll say, hey, here's this deal over here. So I'll drive over, we'll evaluate it. A week later, we're under contract. And so I send an email out to our database to say, hey, we've got a deal hypothetically in Dallas. Here's the pro forma. Here's why we think it's a good deal. We'll leave, you know, a 4 or 5 week window to say, if you are interested in being an investor in this specific property.
So it is tied. The investment is tied to the location. It's not tied to your holdings company.
Exactly. It's tied to the property. So when you invest, you're actually an owner of the LLC that we create to purchase that property. So you're a direct owner of that specific property, not even of our firm. We're just the operators that manage that property.
And going back to the previous topic where you're saying all the data that you put in your website, would you say that's standard for your industry? So say, you know, somebody's not in Texas and they want to invest in wherever they are, Oklahoma, and they find somebody in Oklahoma. Would you say that the data that you provided is what kind of the more reputable, you know, groups will put on their website? Is that something that people should look for?
You know, I've always been a numbers guy and I'm extremely transparent. I think I have the most transparency and numbers out of all of the other competition that I've seen. You know, a lot of the times when you go to some of these other websites, they've got some really pretty looking pictures. They've got a guy in a suit and they said, hey, we promise we're going to make you good money. You know, you'll see some smiling faces and some people with shovels, but you know, they typically don't have a lot of data. They might show you the pictures of the one picture of the building they've done, maybe no before and afters. And then you won't know their track record. You won't know, you know, what did you buy it for? Did you actually accomplish what you thought? You usually have to talk to somebody and then get a third party opinion about, hey, how is that company actually performing? So I'd rather take the guesswork out of it. I mean, I expect that trust is earned. So hey, here's all our data. Here's all our past performance. You know, I just want to put it out there in the open so you can see what we're doing and we're not hiding anything.
So what's the average turnaround here? Because I'm guessing a building goes under contract. I'm going to say they're probably not doing great for whatever reason, and they're selling. So maybe they're at 30 to 50% capacity with tenants, or, I mean, you tell me. And then I guess those contracts of those tenants are 12 months, 24 months before you can kick them out, or you just let them kind of finish their contract and they have to leave because you can't renew it because the company is now under other mandate. Then you go in there, then you have to redo the construction, and then you have to repost it with another team of sales. So what's, can you walk me through the moment that you see an opportunity all the way to, hey, I posted it, you got some funds from my family, what that happens, and when do I potentially see the money back in a, let's say, not perfect scenario, because I'm sure some go super fast, but let's say the average scenario that I should expect my money's going to be locked up.
So typically we tell investors these are five-year holds. You'll get cash flow distribution quarterly along the way, and then we'll typically sell the property on the fifth year, so you'll get a majority of the profits that fifth year. Now, we perform it that way. If we make double your money in 3 years, we're going to sell it in 3 years and give you all your money back sooner. But to answer your question, how long do renovations typically take? So we buy these, some might be 30 or 50% occupied. Most of the time they're 70, 80, 90% occupied residents. Whoever is selling these to us, usually the problems are maintenance has gotten bad and they're only able to charge $600 a month in rent when really you should be able to get $1,000. They just, the place looks ugly and they have bad management and they don't answer the phones, things like that. So even though they have residents, you got to go in there and do improvements. So
you have to wait for 80 to 90% of that building to leave, right? You can't do anything before, right?
It's up to the resident, right? So what we'll do, let's say, you're living in one of the units and you're paying, $600 a month and your lease is up in 2 months. We'll send you a note, say, hey, just so you know, we're the new ownership, we're coming in, we're changing things. Here's all the improvements that we're going to do. Here's why it's going to be so much better. To come along with it being better, your new rent is $900 a month. You can renew at that rent if you want and stay in your unit. We won't renovate it. You're not getting kicked out. Or you can go to this one that we just finished renovating and move across the way and pay the $900 that you were already paying, but you get a brand new renovated unit. Or you can just move out. And then if they move out, then we'll move someone else.
So you're shuffling pieces within the apartment complex, if you may. You're like, hey, you leave on 104, but 108 is all bells and whistles, new countertops, new everything. You're going to move over here. You can stay here. And by the way, our pool is now beautiful and whatever you did to improve the conditions of this livelihood. And so you allow these pieces to move without actually ever vacating it.
Yeah, exactly. We typically keep our properties 90% occupied. And so
I'm in, Ryan. I'm in.
I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm in. All right. No, I mean,
you were going
to
say something.
Sorry to interrupt. I'm just saying, I'm excited now. I'm like, okay, I'm going to write a check. Let's go.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, they're profitable right away when we take over, so we'll keep it 90% occupied and there might be like four vacant units that we're actually renovating. But as soon as those four are done, let's say right now we're finishing up four in August, we have people moving out September 1st. So we'll get three or four new units. We'll renovate those four and we'll do the same in October. So the people are moving into the units that we finished in August. So it's a constant rolling turnover. It's not like we have to evacuate the whole building, start with no income and then start over. We're earning money the whole time.
So what are red flags, Ryan? What is like somebody
for
again?
Who? For him or for us?
No, for us.
Okay. Okay.
So what are red flags? So say again, somebody else is looking at, and they're in Pennsylvania, they're in Philly. And what are things that are common in your line of work where people should go like, oh, let me think about twice about this.
Are you talking about other people that offer what Ryan offers?
Yeah, exactly. Somebody like us is looking for somebody like Ryan, some other place besides Texas.
Understood.
And so what are things that you should kind of think twice before putting your money down?
So, I mean, obviously getting reviews from other investors who overinvested with someone before, reputation is the best.
So if I go to that, I go to that person and I say, hey, give me the name of five people, your last five customers and their phone number. Was that something you could do?
No, that's private information.
It's usually better to find somebody through a referral. So instead of finding somebody and then seeing if they're a good person, if you're interested in this, you go to these real estate meetups, meet people who are real investors and say, who have you invested with?
Where do you find, what's the best place to find the meetups?
There's local real estate investment meetups. If you just Google that, meetup.com, Bigger Pockets has them. There's lots of websites that have bigger ones. Like I'm part of Wheelbarrow Profits Academy. A Real Estate Lab is another group that you can join. Old Capital has a conference. So there's a lot of these groups. If you just look up a real estate syndication events, there's all the way from the local towns all the way to these big national events where you got to pay $2,000 to attend, but you'll meet 1,000 sponsors, And if you find somebody who you've trusted is vested with somebody a couple of times and they see the track record, that's one way. But to answer your question, like, let's say we didn't have any outside reviews. If somebody comes up with their predictions and they back it up with data, instead of saying, hey, I believe that this this part of town is really going to grow, or I think we can, you know, get $1,300 a month, or they have these predictions and a lot of sales sizzle to it. They got to back it up with data. You get to say, where is a comparable property where they're already receiving that rent that you're saying that we can get? Where was it a comparable sale that happened that you think you're going to get that exit sale price? You know, where are you seeing migration patterns and population trends where you think that we're going to be able to raise rents at that same pace over the next 2, 3, 4 years? Are people moving here? Are people moving away? You know, how many jobs are being created? So they've got to have all these data points to be able to back up the assumptions that they're making. So any good sponsor who's a general partner should be able to show you their underwriting. And you don't, you know, underwriting is complicated. You don't have to know everything about underwriting, but you should be able to go through some of the bigger numbers like sale price, rent growth, comparable final exit cap rate, rent price, and be able to say, where are you getting the data for these major points? And where are you seeing that in the economy? So as long as they can show you that data, and it helps if they also have a recommendation, you know, then I'd say, okay, this person knows what they're talking about.
Sounds like the perfect time to ask you, how does the kind of stressful macroeconomics environment in the lending world affect the return on investment to the average Joe investor? Okay. And this is almost like, make a pitch right now as to why, you know, if I want to invest and get a property and rent it and own it, well, right now I'm going to be hit with the feds have hiked the rates significantly. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. By the way, I am now on the, you know, 790 plus 800. Okay. Thank you. I've fixed my credit score since the mattress debacle. Thank you.
Yeah. They'll give you a loan.
But the reality is it doesn't matter if your credit score is phenomenal. You're still going to have to deal with the fact that we are federal mandate of slow down the economy. It's mm-hmm. almost like an imposed recession. So how is that affecting your business? And how would you make a pitch to say, Miguel, right now, if you want to go and buy a house yourself, you're going to be hit with this percentage. Whereas if you give me that down payment to me, I'm going to be able to shield you and I'm going to be able to return your investment within 5 years. And that makes totally more sense than this kind of long play with your own equity. Do you have a way to defend that, or are you equally affected by the macroeconomics, and does it trickle down to the investor in your strategy?
So this might be a little more technical than I usually say, but you know, big picture,
we're doctors. It's okay. Try your best, man.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay. So big picture, you know, we're coming into an economy where they just raised interest rates from 3% a couple of years ago, and now we're at, you know, 7.5% is the interest rate. Commercial real estate trades based on the income. So houses, you trade on emotion. People really want to live in an area. It's worth more. Commercial real estate doesn't look like that. They only look at how profitable is it, and we're going to basically buy the income of this building. So what happens is when interest rates go up, the ability for a deal to become profitable goes down, because every house and every commercial property has a mortgage on it. Usually you put 20-25% down. Well, banks have this rule, at least in commercial real estate, where your property has to be at least 25% more profitable than the mortgage payment. So if your mortgage payment was, let's say, $10,000 at a 3% interest rate, well, now at 7, you're paying, you know what, $22,000. Let's say you were making $1,500 or $15,000 a month on income. Well, now you don't qualify for this bank loan. So this property that this guy thought was worth this much money isn't worth as much money as it was before, because nobody can qualify for a bank loan to buy it at the price that he wants. So either you're paying 50% down with cash, or the seller's reducing their price. And you know, some sellers just don't want to sell, but in commercial real estate, everybody has a balloon payment on their loan. Now, sometimes it's 10 or 15 years out, but a majority of the time, every 5 years that resets. So every 5 years, you either have to sell, refinance, or pay off your loan. Almost everybody refinances. But what that means is that when they're going to refinance, their 3% rate is going to have to turn into a 6 or 7% rate. And they're going to have to, you know, decide, am I going to have to put another $1 million of my own money into this property to keep it? Or am I just going to sell it? So majority of people are just going to sell, because that's a smart thing to do. And when they go to sell, the bank's going to say, we can only give you a loan of $3 million. And you think your property is worth 7. No one's going to pay that difference. So these prices are going to come down because interest rates are higher. Now, you know, looking forward, no one has a crystal ball, but like realistically, I think the Fed has raised interest rates very quickly. I think there's going to be more layoffs in the job market. And I think that the Fed is going to have to respond to a recession and they're going to have to lower interest rates. That might be in a year or two or three. Who knows? But I think at one point they'll have to do something. So when that happens, prices will start to go back up and we can refinance and we can get lower payments. But you know, with if you try to time the market and say, I'm only going to buy when it's at the bottom and I'm only going to sell when it's at the top, we never really know. There's so much fear, there's so much emotion that goes into it. It's harder to do that. And it's better to just dollar cost average and say, let me just constantly be buying little bits of investments all along the way. And overall, I'll outperform somebody that thinks they know when the top and the bottom are. On top of that, you know, let's say we are at the top and let's say we are at a bottom. But when you're at the top, let's say you find a really good deal from somebody that, you know, didn't take care of their property. Well, just because the market's at the top, if you still got a really good price and you can run it in a profitable way year over year, and you just are not forced to sell it when the market is down, it's going to be a good deal. It's the same when you're in a low market and things are really bad. As long as you found a good deal and that deal is profitable and you can make it even more profitable through operating it correctly, you're going to make money in the long run. So that's why it's just hard to time the market. It's better to be opportunistic about finding the deals, running them effectively, and just not getting out too far in front of your skis, thinking that, hey, I should buy just because the market's down, even though this particular deal doesn't look as good as it could.
Saying that, going back to kind of red flags, is there like a number of deals? Like, again, I'm looking for someone to invest my money with. Is there a number of deals that is kind of the sweet spot where like that somebody like you should be doing, you know, a year? If I'm looking for clues, if you're like a reputable operator, I was gonna ask you, hey man, how many deals of these are you doing a year? And can you give me the information? Is there a number you can say, okay, this guy's not doing enough, or this guy's doing too much, or?
First of all, whoever you want to work with, they need to be full time. There's a lot of people right now, real estate's popular, apartments are popular. People are trying to be engineers and do this on the side, and they're doing it, but you're not able to do it effectively. So whoever you're working with, they need to be full time, and their partners need to be full time in the business. And preferably they have a construction guy, an equity guy, and a deal finder guy. You know, you need each of those pieces and they need to have specialties. So that's kind of the ideal team. Once you have that in place, you know, right now the market is a little tough, maybe one or two deals this year because people just aren't transacting. People aren't selling, and it's a difference between where it makes sense to buy and sell. But in the next 2 or 3 years, things could be turning around. It's a lot of work to take a property from when you buy it all the way to really renovate it. It takes about, you know, what, 9 to 18 months, depending on how much work you're doing. So if you're buying one, you know, even every quarter, that's kind of the max where you just bought one. You got to spend the next 6 to 9 months getting it stabilized, getting it operationally good. If you're buying another one after that and after that, that's kind of the max that you can do. You know, we did 5 deals last year. One of them I was a very passive partner on, so I didn't have a lot to do on that particular one. But the four that we operated were, they were taking every bit of effort that I had. I mean, I typically get up at 5. I'm sending out emails. You know, I'm visiting sites, you know, at least 1, 2 times a week. So we were hustling just to make those 4 deals that I was an active part on. And I think doing any more than that can be tough. Now, you can do small deals that are 20, 30 units, and you can only have a few investors. But if you're really big, you can do 200 or 300 unit deals. And hey, if you do one deal that's 300 units the whole year, I mean, you can really watch that one basket that has all your eggs, and it can do great.
Is there a specific number of doors that again is kind of the sweet spot? If you kind of, you know, stratify from and you divide them in groups like 20 doors, 50 doors, 100 doors, 300 doors, is there one sweet spot where you're like, hey, this is kind of like what you want? You want 50, you want 100. These are like kind of like if you average them out, they make the most stable, safe investment, or like, or as such.
So, you know, each band of unit numbers is good for a certain type of investor, and you kind of pick which one fits your niche. So if you're just a wealthy individual and you've bought houses and duplexes, fourplexes, you might go to buying 10 or 20 units. It's very hard for that individual to get above, you know, 20 or 30 units because they're a one-man show. They're doing it by themselves, and maybe they figured out how to do the management well. And but it's hard to really scale if they're just using their own capital. On the flip side, if you get to properties that are 100 units or more, they become operationally efficient. You can have one full-time leasing agent, one full-time maintenance guy that oversees the whole property, and you can get a lot better terms on your lending. And it becomes very efficient to do 100-unit properties or more. However, when you get to that size, you're competing against institutional capital. Most of these deals trade between, you know, $10 to $100 million. So you're dealing with BlackRock, Grant Cardone. There's a lot of guys that they have a lot of capital behind them and they don't necessarily need to make as much profit, but they just need to do a lot of deals at scale, and they're very good at what they do. So you're going to have a lot of competition finding a really, really profitable deal in that area. So our group likes to stay between 20 to 80 units. We found that's the most efficient where you can find, you know, mom and pops who have maybe owned a couple of properties, but they've just let them go, or they're ready to retire. Or maybe they bought something from New York and they didn't really have the time to work on it, you know, over here in Texas. So we found the best deals in that range between 20 to 80 units. And because they're in our backyard, I can drive to these properties and I can keep eyes on them and work them efficiently. It takes a little more legwork, but you get higher rate of return. So for instance, you know, our average internal rate of return will do 16, 17%. You know, if you were to buy the same, you know, 100 class unit or 100 unit building, you might be looking at 12 to 14% rate of return on some of these other deals, you know, and same with like houses, you might be in that 10 to 12 band range, but it's taking a lot of your time if you're a one man show. So we found that you can make more money in this 20 to 80 units.
So to be clear, do you get your money back when you sell, or as the rental gets up rented, I don't even know. I made that up. Is that a thing? Up rental? You know, you go from 600 to 900. I'm going to call that an up rental. As it gets up rented, do you start then doing distributions of capital at a quarterly or a week? Yearly basis of some sort, or
every hour I'll send you what we made. Right. We do quarterly distributions of whatever the profits are along the way. So, you know, the first year, the capital is being used to renovate the property. So we're doing improvements, we're putting new signs up, we're putting new landscaping and stones out, you know. So the first year, there's not going to be very many distributions. You know, some of our deals might have, you know, $100,000 is an easy investment, you know, just to use round numbers, right? So you might only get $1,000 or $2,000 that first year. So the first quarter, you might get zero. Second quarter, you might get zero. The third quarter, you might get $500. The last quarter, you might get, you know, $1,000, you know, but that next year, you'll probably get 5% of your money. So every quarter, you'll get $1,200 paycheck just kind of coming in quarterly. So it's not that much on $100,000. You get a majority when we sell it. Let's say that fifth year, you might get a $60,000, $70,000 check that last year. So a majority of profit comes at the end because it's all tied up in the equity. Now, what we do offer is saying, hey, once we sell this property, we're going to have another one lined up right behind it. So you can do what's called a 1031 exchange, and you can avoid paying any capital gains tax on that. And then you can come into this next deal and carry that tax gain along the way into the next one, and then just keep rolling it and rolling it.
Oh, well, wait a minute, but that's really important.
Yeah,
like
that's really important.
As we, I know that we're getting kind of here on the hour, and I want to be respectful of your time, Ryan, but I think that we definitely need to put a minute or two on this.
Yeah.
You flew by that, but I think that's brilliant, and I think that's incredibly important for our audience to know, is when you get to the point that you close a deal, and you're going to return my money, mm-hmm. I am going to pay a significant amount of money mm-hmm. to the government on taxes, right? I'm making a sale. And so I don't know what the examples would be. I can't, Ryan, give me an example. I came in with $100,000. It's 5 years. You close the deal. How much money am I going to see in return? Give or take.
100,000 profit. So you'll end up with 200,000.
Okay.
The original 100.
But you're going to return the 100, and then I have 100 profit, but that 100 profit is going to be taxed, or the whole 200 is going to be taxed. So how much am I actually going to get liquidity in my account?
Texas, we don't have state income tax, but yeah, you'll pay 20% capital gains tax. If you're in California or New York, you'll pay state income tax. You might pay 30% in those states.
So safe to say 20% to about $40,000 mm-hmm. is going to stay.
Yeah.
But you're saying that by the time that one deal is done, you're probably brokering another one. And there is an ability for me to roll over that without having to pay taxes on capital gain, because you're not actually executing that. So instead of me having to pay the government, I get to keep the 200,000 and roll it completely into the next project. Is that not correct?
That's correct. Yeah, you can keep rolling, and then you have a bigger and bigger piece of every property that you buy as it grows up over time. And there's another kicker too. So, and this is just loopholes where I think Donald Trump and all these really wealthy people got, they stay wealthy. So what you can do is, as you roll these properties over and over and over, you get, old enough, let's say you get to retirement age, you put that large investment by that point into a trust. You name yourself and your kids as a beneficiary of that trust. When you pass away, your cost basis resets, meaning let's say you were to owe the government $300,000 in capital gains tax because your original 100,000 investment turned into a million and you owe
Or
them a lot more. When it's in
$3 million, or
trust, you will pass away and then that resets, and then your kids no longer have to pay that $300,000 capital gains. That's just generational wealth given to your family. So that's one of the other, magical benefits of doing this type of real estate investing. And I'll blow your mind with one more thing. When you come in, let's say you do a $100,000 investment in a deal. We do this study called cost segregation. So normally properties depreciate over time, at least according to the IRS. So you get a little bit of a write-off every year on your taxes. We do this study, cost segregation study, will front load a lot of that. And there's a lot of mechanics. I could spend a long time talking about it, but basically you'll get a huge amount of this depreciation write-off. It's not a real expense. You'll still get dividends just like you would to your bank account. But on paper, to the IRS, it looks like you had this gigantic loss. And it can be 30 or 40% of your investment as a loss. So if you put $100,000 in this year, you could get a $40,000 write-off to go against other capital gains or other passive income. So much so that, and it can be carried forward. If you don't have $40,000 of capital gains income this year, you can keep it until we sell the deal. And that could be forever from now, right? So let's say the income from this property makes you that $5,000 a year. You don't pay any income or any passive, what is it, either capital gains or dividend income to the IRS on that income until you've used up all of that cost segregation appreciation. So it's how all these rich people stay rich, is they just don't pay any taxes. Like I won't pay any taxes this year, just because of the way that these real estate deals work.
I've always said it, if you're smart enough, you can use the system towards your advantage.
I mean,
And
you just need to inform it. You just
you
need
need to
to
be informed.
be
But
informed.
again,
You don't
to
need to be
your,
smart.
but to
You
your, co
need to like
okay,
inform yourself.
you need to be street smart.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Well, yeah.
And they're not like loopholes. And to be very clear to our audience, these are not illegal practices. These are
No.
absolutely by the book, created, established protocols that you can use to protect the wealth of your family,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, these are legal, and the government has these to incentivize investing in real estate. And because we do create a lot of jobs.
Yeah, they want
Yeah.
people to create jobs. They want
Yeah.
people to, there's construction, there's investment, there's jobs. I mean, right now, funny enough, our macroeconomics, worst time
Yeah.
and so many things. Our job market is phenomenal right now. So leave it to America, land of the free, and a great, phenomenal place to have all these opportunities. And man, I just want to say, Lucas, thank you for bringing him on. Thank you, Ryan, for being here. And I think everybody that listens is going to be blown. It's going to just create serotonin rushes. And I think you may get a call or two from our listeners.
Yeah.
Well, I
And
appreciate
thank
it. Yeah, the our website's topproducerinvestmentcapital.com. We if you are interested, there's a request and invitation form. You fill out a little bit of info about yourself, and you can book a call with us, and we'll learn more about your situation and see if you're a good fit.
Yeah, and you've had that QRS code the entire show in the back,
Yeah,
so I bet you that people could
exactly.
just like look at it, right?
You should do that for your practice.
Well,
You
yeah,
have a
I'm
QR
gonna
code right now.
my Hope Vascular Podiatry PLLC in Houston, Texas. If anybody needs anything, it's right on the camera. Just zoom into it. Anyway, Ryan, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thanks
I
for
know a
being.
lot of people will love having it, and Lucas, thank you again for bringing Ryan over. It's been a phenomenal time.
Yeah, Ryan, thanks for being a great friend and for spending the time with us. And yeah.
And we'll see each other in Puerto Rico when Lucas someday invites
Yeah,
us
yeah, yeah.
to come and share together.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been great. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate sharing.
All right.
Awesome.
Pura
Ryan, have a great day.
vida. Pura vida. Bye-bye.
Vamos.